Hi, everyone.
Hey, squad.
For anyone new here, we are Elite Squad, SVU in review. And what we do here is we are recappers. We recap Law & Order SVU from the very beginning until Elliot Stabler leaves the show. We won't have it after that.
We won't. Nope. That's when we get to do Touched by an Angel.
Yes, our real passion. See, we started this podcast thinking, I guess we'll do SVU. No, I'm kidding. We're massive SVU fans, which is why we are recapping it from the very beginning, except for when Stabler leaves the show. And we also give a light commentary. And I do mean light. Well, it's heavy, but it's light because we giggle while we say it. Sometimes we get mad, though. We do.
I'm going to be mad this episode.
Yeah, I'm going to be I'm going to be a lot mad.
But I'm excited. We're starting season 3. It's a new season.
Yeah.
Everyone looks the same except Olivia's got her sick pixie.
Yep.
Finally, she's been like working towards it, and now it's here. Now, it might be this season, but I recently read an interview where Mariska talked about how she went to get her hair cut and she got drunk with her hairstylist and then was like, oh shit, I cut my hair too short. And so she called the show and was like, hey guys, I like kind of did a thing. And I think they like they kind of gave her shit and were like, oh, well, we don't know if that's okay. And she was like, okay, well, I did it, so sorry.
They put Stabler in hats, which was more distracting than any of Olivia's hair changes.
They made us stay in February and then brought us right back to February in season 3. And they're like, Mariska, you maybe can't have that haircut.
Guys, we're back in February. It's February 13th at some point.
I don't know how that happened.
I don't know.
Like, oh my God.
I started rocking back and forth on my couch.
There's no reason to make it February. Like, there's no snow on the ground. It could be anywhere from November to, like, March, October.
They didn't have to do this. Also, at one point, they're looking at a photo. And did you notice that they show us the date? And it says, like, October something, 2001. And they go, look at the date, February.
I did not put that in my notes, but I was like...
I was like, maybe I'm missing something.
Well, back then you couldn't pause the TV and go, excuse me. And they were not accounting for that.
It's so true.
We were not meant to go back to the show and be able to be like, what's going on? Why is it February? But also, October would have made so much more sense. I know they don't film the episodes in true order.
No, and... like, it really doesn't matter. It's just that it's weird to do. As writers, too, I'm like, come on. This is just lazy. What are you doing? Or maybe not writers. I guess that's a graphics department error. But they're taking cues from the writers. Like, just everyone's... what is the deal?
It's like our set... well, we have, like, made fun of our set people before.
Oh, yeah.
Well, today we are talking about Law & Order SVU, Season 3, Episode 1, Repression. Original air date, September 28th, 2001, and directed by Henry Bronckteen. First timer? So this is the first episode to air post 9/11, and in the original broadcast, Steve Zurden-Kilton, who does the opening narration, does a slightly different one that pays tribute to the victims and the first responders. They have since taken this out, so if you're watching on Hulu or if you see it on TV, it's the usual opening narration.
Oh, that's a cool fact.
I wish they kind of kept that in because that's interesting. And it's also the first episode where they remove the Twin Towers from the credits.
Oh, everyone was doing that for a while.
Yeah, Friends did that. So I love my opening. A young, troubled-looking woman, Megan Ramsey, walks through the hustle and bustle of the precinct. She just comes in looking troubled.
At first I was like, oh, someone's au pair has come to report a crime.
What is up with her huge quilted barn jacket?
Yes, okay. As a horse girl, actually, she's a horse girl, we find out. But I too wondered why the barn jacket outside of barn hours, not Manhattan.
It's like something my grandma would have worn to go gardening.
She definitely dressed like a horse trainer this whole episode. Even her ponytail, she had a low pony with like one of those thin bow clips, which my fine hair could never. It would just slip right out.
She was so horse girl coded, which also horse girls do tend to be troubled. So this so much sense.
What do you mean? No, they are some of the most troubled people, horse girl. Like, I'm eccentric. but they're troubled.
She wears the same outfit in the entire episode.
I don't think she changes once. Like, one time, I don't think she has a different beret. I don't think she has a different jacket, a different sweater neath her jacket.
She must not have worn the barn jacket to court, but I can't prove it because I can't remember. So she approaches the doors to the special victims unit, and through the window, we see Stabler Munch and Tutuola. They're just like chatting it up. And she starts to turn, like maybe losing her nerve, when Olivia approaches her and asks if she can help. I said this earlier, but Mariska has finally committed to the pixie, and she looks absolutely amazing.
Yeah, Benson's like, can I help you? And I'm like, drop the skincare routine, why don't you? For God's sake, woman.
Stylist.
Can you help me? Marry me. Ma'am, please let go of Mariska Hargitay.
I deadass never want to meet her because I think I would be really inappropriate.
Oh,
I'd be like, you're so beautiful. I love you so much. Will you be my mom? And I also really love my mom. And she'd be like, okay, that's a lot. I have like the worst tone shift I have to do right now. Megan has a single tear running down her face as she says, I want to report a rape. Olivia escorts her immediately to the nice interrogation room.
Benson goes, let's go somewhere private. And I'm like, because you look a mess.
Let's go somewhere a little more private.
How dare you look this way and I look like this. And she's so much shorter than Mariska Hargitay. So it's so funny because it's just come like, why don't you come with me, you absolute mess. Is that a barn jacket?
So Megan is quiet at first, but then she tells Olivia that he followed her to her apartment last night. She doesn't know how he got in the building, but when she opened her door, he pushed his way in. So Megan is crying as she says that she told him to leave and that she never wanted to see him again. He slammed the door, and then Megan, as she's recounting this, starts to cry harder and goes, oh God. Olivia asks who did this to her, like her boyfriend, and Megan looks up at Olivia. He's my father. So we're starting to realize now that this isn't really reporting one rape. It's a case of like abuse and incest. We'll delve into this further. So now that we know that we have a daughter of a father on our hands, Olivia calls in the resident father, Elliot Stabler. And that is 100% what it seemed like to me. She was like, oh shit, I need a father.
She's like, wait a minute. Let me just go get the father here. You're a little older than his kids, so he might not care as much about you this episode.
Megan describes how the abuse started. First it was stroking and then touching. He would help her undress her bed and sometimes take off his shirt and then his pants. When she was 12, he raped her. He told her not to cry and showed her pictures and said that's how daddies love their little girls. Olivia asks if the abuse has continued, and she says it stopped after she got her period when she was 14. Then Olivia asks if anything sexual happened last night, and Megan's like, no, but we had a horrible fight. And it's like, why are you fucking telling them about this fight?
Well, yeah, why? So are you reporting?
Well, she then says, if he hadn't had to catch a plane, who knows what he would have done? Like, oh no, he wanted to rape me, but he had to catch a flight.
Right. Even though he stopped when I got my period.
Stabler chimes in with some more bad news. The statute of limitations has run out on the prior abuse. So Megan goes, what about Lily? For fuck's sake, Megan, who is Lily?
Right? Like, oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I forgot that you mentioned Lily earlier and we just completely glossed over it. No. What about Lily?
My favorite part is Stabler basically is like, who the fuck is Lily?
He does his little like eye twitch where he's kind of like.
So Lily is Megan's little sister who is 7. And this is the same age Megan was when the abuse began. Olivia asks if she saw anything. And Megan tells her that yesterday she went to her parents' house and she walked in on her father touching Lily the way he used to touch her. This dumb broad told the story so out of order.
Really? Because, like, yeah. Like, then you should have started not with, we got into a horrible fight last night. It's like, so you're reporting the touching of your sister. And then also, obviously, your own assault. Megan!
Well, she says to Olivia, I want to report a rape.
Yes, she does.
But that implies there's just one, not like a series of abuse. Why wouldn't you just go in and be like, I want to report abuse.
Or, yeah, I have to report like a crime. Like you could even just say crime.
As you guys can tell, we are not huge fans of Megan Ramsay.
Megan Ramsay sucks.
Megan Ramsay, most annoying victim.
Yeah, no,
when we do our season 3 recap. Winner right here.
We have in this season, I think we have 23 episodes. Yeah, I cannot imagine anyone taking her place. This is her.
So in the bullpen, Cragen is just like dressed to the fucking nines in his captain's uniform. He's got like all his little badges on. He's looking cute. Daddy. Cute. Olivia approaches him with some background on Megan's father. Cragen is on his way to the mayor's luncheon, so she better give this rundown quick. And I was like, oh, la-di-da, Cragen. You know when he gets to rub elbows with the rich, he's like, guys, I gotta go.
He might have been on, maybe they all are on some tranquilizers this episode, because they all seemed a little bit, like, kind of calm. They were, like, he was like, well, I'm heading to the mayor's luncheon. You want to make this quick? And then later on, he says to them, like, get back to me when you have more on that. But it's, like, very kind of, he's, like, looted out.
I don't think a single SVU person raises their voice this episode.
Everyone's
calm. So Evan Ramsey runs Sutherland Pharmaceuticals, and he just donated a wing to a children's hospital. Rebecca Sutherland is his wife, and she is the daughter of the company's founding father. There are two other children in the family, Jody, who is 15, and Lily, who is 7. Munch and Finn are checking with Children's Services to see if the family has any priors. Cragen asks about the mother, and Stabler explains that Megan isn't currently speaking to her, but they are going to go have a chat with Rebecca right now.
Jody.
Dun dun. So we meet Rebecca Ramsey, who is played by Amy Irving. Irving is most famous for her roles as Sue Snell in 1976's Carrie. She was in Yentl in 1983 and The Fury in 1978. I apologize to anyone who likes things in order because that was all over the place. She also provides the singing voice for Jessica Rabbit in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And for my millennials, she does some voice acting in An American Tale, Bible Goes West.
Oh, I didn't know that. It's so cute.
A favorite of mine.
I love Don Bluth. He's like, we're going to make movies for kids. We're going to make them like pretty dark.
So fun fact, she has been married to Steven Spielberg. They're no longer together. And she lost the role of Marion Ravenwood when she and Spielberg broke up. That role would, of course, later go on to our friend from Scourge. Oh, God, no.
Margot Kidder.
Not Marco Kidder, Karen Allen. Sorry, for, I was like,
Scourge. That was my fault. I was like, wait, who else would it be? But I'm like, Karen Allen. Like, Brittany, that was the oldest person in that episode. No. Different episode.
So they appear to be in the Ramsey home, and Rebecca is very defensive of her husband. She explains that they have been married for 19 years, and basically she would know if anything were going on under her roof. Now, her father is randomly here, too. Like, great, have a big private discussion in front of your dad. He is not so sure about Evan. He says she's always had a blind spot. And Rebecca replies that Megan is just angry and lashing out. But her dad is like, well, where do you think this anger is coming from? So Evan has some champions and Evan has some enemies.
And it's like the grandfather's being appropriately concerned, I guess. But I do wonder, it's like, I feel like in a normal situation, if you've known him for that long, you know what I mean? Like, you might still question. You might be like, wait, seriously? Like, even if you just don't like him, you wouldn't immediately be like, yeah, no, that makes sense.
Right. Because, I mean, well, we can talk about this later, but like, we do find out that they have all like some animus between them because he doesn't like how Evan's running the company. But like, that doesn't necessarily mean you would turn around and be like, oh, you're molesting my grandkids. Like, holy shit.
He's like, well, makes sense why Megan's so fucked. Maybe it's how fucked Megan is. They're like, I mean, it's got to be this. Otherwise, what is it?
But Rebecca has an answer for this. She thinks that this is all because of a therapist that Megan is seeing, Dr. Wharton. Megan started seeing her once she started going to Columbia. Since then, Megan has become an expert on what she calls the family dysfunction. And I can only imagine how annoying this is.
Oh, my God.
When your one family member starts to go to therapy and all of a sudden they have all the answers to all the problems and have an answer for everyone in the family. Rebecca even says that this isn't the first time she has made up stories for attention, though never anything like this. BNS asks to talk to Jody and Lily, and though Rebecca is reluctant, Mr. Sutherland kind of like puffs up and he's like, no, they'll be down at the station to talk to you.
Yeah, he's like, Rebecca, I'm going to just remind you that I'm your rich ass father. So actually,
Well, dun-dun, we head to Whole Life Recovery Center, where BNS meet with Dr. Wharton, who is played by Shirley Knight, an actress who I found out was just one award shy of an EGOT. Her most famous roles are all from, like, the 60s and 70s, so I can't really say any, like, popular movies that I personally know. But she was more recently, and by more recently, I mean not really, in The Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood, Grandma's Boy, and Paul Blart Mall Cop. And I'm not trying to, like, make fun of her because I know those are, like, sillier roles. She is a very award-winning. She, in fact, almost won an Emmy for being in a Law & Order episode. She's quite award-winning. I just think her more heavier roles are older.
I love Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood. But yeah, she's a very small role in that, too, which is interesting.
The book was really good. I just don't remember much about what happens in it, except it's like, girls running amok in the South.
It was when they tried to treat alcoholism with pills. And they were basically sugar pills.
She was drunk.
It's dead ass.
She was drunk.
So she tells them that Megan came to her suffering from bulimia and depression. Olivia asks what she was depressed about, and Dr. Wharton says that eating disorders often signal a deeper emotional trauma, but she only recently was told about the incest. She explains that Megan built a wall between her and her father, and only recently did these floodgates open and the truth came out. Stabler asks why she, Dr. Wharton, didn't report this, and she says that since Megan is an adult, she could not break confidentiality. And she's, in fact, only talking to them now because Megan gave her permission. Dr. Wharton repeatedly asked her if she thought Jody or Lily were being abused, and she always said no until recently. Olivia asks if Megan is emotionally ready for the strain of a police investigation, because again, they were not very impressed by what they saw at the beginning of this episode.
No, they really weren't. They're definitely trying to find a way to get out of it.
They're like, are we sure? Dr. Wharton says she is still struggling, but since she went to the police, she believes she's on the road to recovery. And I'm like, that's not an answer. What?
I like how she talks down to them in every scene, too. Like, she's like, well, she's still struggling.
Well, dun dun. Over at Child Services, a social worker tells Finn and Munch that she had to go all the way to the basement to dig up this file. It's from 7 years ago when Megan Ramsey was 11, and a resident at Mercy General made a report after Rebecca brought Megan in after a bicycle accident. She had vaginal bleeding and was having trouble urinating, and the resident noticed bruising on her backside. They did investigate. Megan told them that the bruises were from riding horses on her grandfather's farm, and the pediatrician told them that she had a UTI from basically too many bubble baths. There were a few follow-up visits, and the case was closed.
Ugh, she reminded me how gross kids are.
Oh yeah, kids always have like weird little infections and stuff like that.
It's true. I was thinking about it because I'm like, I guess that would all look kind of suspicious at first. I can tell you that the horseback riding thing, you have to be riding really wrong to fuck your bum up like that. She was probably bouncing around in there and not really trying. But yeah, it made me think of all the times like kids are so, they're like really resilient. Like they heal a lot more quickly, but when they do get hurt, it's like so gross. Like I remember I got a really bad blister and my finger was like ripped open for weeks. Like I had a hole in my finger.
I used to get a ton of weird like skin infections. Like
yeah,
like, other people don't normally hear about. Like I had something called like impetigo and I had something called like pityriasis rosiaire. It's like, what? So back at the station, Stabler tells Cragen that Megan has a history of emotional problems, and Olivia, the only time she really defends Megan, is basically like, duh, she's an incest victim.
It's very lazy. Again, kind of Xanax-y. She's like, I mean, she's an incest victim. It would make sense. Maybe I'm doing the opposite of, she was screaming. Now I'm like, God,
no,
they were
so
chill.
Chill. Cragen says that Evan is a rich, well-liked white man, so they really have to make sure they do their due diligence this time. What he really says is, let's make sure we have all the ammunition before we go to war. Munch enters and relays what he found over at Child Services, and Cragen tells them that Evan is currently out of town and to find out as much as they can before he gets back. Olivia glances into the bullpen and announces that the Ramsey children are here. So Cragen tells them to separate the kids, get their story, and he will try to wear down Rebecca. A-dun-dun. Olivia takes Lily, who is coloring, as Liv asks her questions. Lily is played by a baby Sarah Hyland, and normally I would do my whole spiel about Sarah Hyland, but She's going to come back and get her own episode, so I am going to save all my raving for then.
Plus, she's so famous, I'm sure all of you know her name. Sarah Hyland.
Sarah Hyland. Olivia asks Lily what she and her dad do together, and Lily's like, well, sometimes we go to the park and ride horses. This family is obsessed with horses. Oh,
they
my
love
God.
Horses.
Mr. Ramsey reads stories to her. They play games.
He's a good dad. It's suspicious.
I know. When Olivia asks Lily what kind of games, she gets quiet. Liv pushes her, and Lily asks why everyone is so mad at her dad. She says that Megan said he was doing bad things, but she honestly doesn't seem to know what. Olivia asks if her dad ever does anything she doesn't like, and she's like racking her brain, and she's like, I guess sometimes he yells and says bad words, which I was like, oh, you wouldn't like our podcast, sweetheart.
Oh, Lily, don't listen to our podcast.
But Olivia pushes her, and she's like, what else does your dad do that you don't like? And Lily gets kind of fed up, and she's like, nothing. My daddy loves me. Well, dun-dun, Stabler is interviewing Jody, who's played by, I don't know how to say her last name, but it's Blythe Auffarth?
Auffarth, who art in heaven.
A-U-F-F-A-R-T-H. I'm sorry to this woman. We last saw her last season in Pixies. She was one of the gymnasts, and she's the one who talked about how that creepy guy gave her body lotion and told her to think of him when she was using it.
Ugh.
She was also in that Sex and the City episode, and I'm talking to my Sex and the City fans, not you, Paige.
You'd no, like, it's
Brittany,
okay.
You're like, Brittany, I don't know what you're talking about. It's the Kat Dennings episode where it's her, like, I was going to say her sweet 16. No, it's her bar mitzvah, and they, like, act like little adults, and she's one of Kat Dennings' friends.
Ironically, I have seen that one, okay. But it's I know that reference, but if you were to be like, and then there was this other moment, I'd be like, okay, well, actually.
Like, I don't know what you're talking about. So Stabler asks Jody if her father has ever touched her in a way that made her feel uncomfortable, and she's like, no, he would never do that. She says that he and Megan would argue, but he was just trying to keep her out of trouble. And he said that her boyfriend was bad news, and she thought he was being controlling. We don't get to hear enough about this boyfriend, but it does seem that there is more to the story surrounding this boyfriend. If you, like, really think about this episode, it seems like there's a deep, not like a deeper conspiracy, but like a lot more going on that they can't really get into with, like, Megan and her father and, like, her relationship with this boyfriend and, like,
yeah,
her getting back at her dad because he threatened to cut off her tuition.
It's layered enough in a way where it's like, yeah, I have a lot of questions, and they're probably, if we got more time with this episode, we would discover more, because there's a lot there, like, but we're kind of just left with Megan's messed up.
Yeah. So Stabler asks about Evan Ramsey's relationship with Lily, and Jody's like, oh my God, he never yells at her. They go to the park, he reads to her, and Stabler's like, is there anything else? And Jody suddenly seems a little nervous.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere.
She was very sure, and then suddenly she goes, well, oh, and also for me, I'm mentioning this, Jody speaks in a transatlantic accent, and if you don't know what that is, it's how old people in old movies speak. Katharine Hepburn is a good reference if you need one, speaking very much like this.
My running theory that I have no evidence for is that this is how her acting teacher taught her to act, because she does the same thing in Pixies.
Oh, yeah.
It's not as blatant because she literally only talks for like 2 seconds, and I was trying to, like, work on it while she was talking, but
it's very pointed.
It is. She finally says that sometimes he goes to Lily's room at night and she hears crying, and he also still gives her baths with the door locked. She further adds that a few nights ago, she got up in the middle of the night to get a drink of water and found her dad changing Lily's sheets. Lily was crying in the corner with her bottoms off, and Evan was acting weird and said she wet the bed, and then Jody pauses really dramatically and goes, she hasn't wet the bed since she was two. And we never get an like you said, we get kind of an explanation, but like the locking the door for baths, like that is kind of weird.
That's like throughout this, that was the weirdest thing for me. And I started thinking about it because I'm like, when did I stop needing help in the bath? Like, when did my parents trust me enough not to drown and leave me alone? And now I'm like, I have no memories. I know they must have been in there with me, because you don't leave anybody under a certain age alone in a bathtub. But in my memories, I just don't remember them ever being in there. I don't even remember my mom.
I Googled when you can stop, basically, and it said between 6 and 8, kids should, like, be bathing themselves.
Yeah.
So she's actually kind of at the age where she shouldn't be. I would think at that age it would be more like you need to keep the bathroom door open just so I can, like, make sure you're okay in there. Like, but, like, I trust you to wash yourself. Like, I'm just
right
here if you need me. Maybe poke your head in, make sure they're not drowning. I don't know.
Exactly. But that was the one thing. The other stuff I was like, yeah, okay, she wet the bed and he's being weird because no one wants to deal with piss.
So Cragen and Mrs. Ramsey have been watching through Cragen's secret window and she's very upset. She's like, well, this can't be true. And Cragen's like, well, can we search Lily's room? That, like, might help us, you know, push things in either direction. And Mrs. Ramsey's like, I just can't take it. She just, like, rushes out of the room. Olivia finds her in the hall and there's, like, someone's here to see you. And it's Megan, who approaches her with her arms crossed, just looking sullen. She's just like, hi.
Mother.
So Mrs. Ramsey starts to cry and she's like, it's not true. And Megan, oh my God, the Ramsey women right now. Megan also is crying and she's like, he raped me and he raped me when I was 12. Where were you? Finally, this is enough to convince Rebecca, who's like, I didn't know. The two hug and Olivia tells Mrs. Ramsey they're going to need to examine Jody and Lily and they need permission to search the house. Mrs. Ramsey tells them to do whatever they need to do and continues to hold Megan. Dun dun. At the Ramsey house, the Ramsey women are all huddled together as Rebecca tells Olivia that he's going to be home any minute. And Olivia's basically like, yeah, okay, we'll deal with it.
Evan Ramsey's fast approaching.
Stabler calls Olivia up to Lily's bedroom, and when she arrives, he holds up the mattress on the bed to show her that there is a pile of child sex abuse material underneath. It is the biggest, like, the predator who printed these out, printed them out on fucking 8.5 by 11 sheets. So there's just huge, huge pictures, and they're clearly not of, honestly, they're so big that you can tell they're not of anything.
You know, when people, like, sit on the photocopier.
It's like grayscale and, like, super zoomed in on whatever.
It's ridiculous.
Stupid. A tech points out that there's also a pair of men's underwear under the mattress. And that's when we hear Evan Ramsey arriving home and he's calling out for Rebecca. He's like, is everything okay here? BNS head downstairs to find a very confused Evan Ramsey. And they're like, you need to come downtown. And he's like, okay.
The women are, like, hugging each other all in a corner, like, shaking, like,
can you, like, fucking believe it? This guy leaves to go do business elsewhere and he comes home and his entire family's, like, shaking in the corner and there's cops, like, busting down his house. He's probably like, what the hell?
Who do you think paid for that butterfly mural on Lily's wall?
So BNS have Evan in the mean interrogation room, and he is telling them he did not rape his daughter. He explains she is just angry because he threatened to stop paying her college tuition if she didn't break up with her boyfriend and start buckling down. Olivia's like, okay, so she's crying rape to get back at you? And he's like, I legitimately have no idea. He keeps trying to connect with her. She keeps pulling farther away. They ask him about him and Lily, and he's like, she has nightmares. That's why I'm in her room at night. Olivia's like, I wonder why, and tosses the huge stack of abuse material at him. And he's like, okay, he takes one look and is like, oh my God, and, like, throws it back like, that's disgusting.
Yeah, she's like, oh, she having nightmares because of these?
And he's like, what the fuck is this? So Stabler tells him that they were printed on a printer like the one in his office. And furthermore, Megan has broken her silence and it's only a matter of time before the other daughters do too. And he's like, I dead ass have done nothing wrong. But BNS are kind of like on one now and they're like, dude, you know what they do to child molesters in prison, right? Finally, he's had enough. He's like, can I just get my lawyer? I don't know what the hell's going on. So outside, Cabot asks Cragen if there's literally any evidence that corroborates this rape. And he's like, well, just Megan's testimony. They did the examinations on Lily and Jody. Jody's is negative. Lily has some slight irritation, but otherwise her test is inconclusive. Cabot is clearly not impressed with this evidence. Cragen tells her that Megan passed the poly, which further does not impress her.
Yeah.
It's so funny. She is like ready to go. She's like, yeah, okay, you've got no evidence, bye. And Cregan's like, Cabot, please. And she's like, okay. Well, no. He's like, well, otherwise he's just going to go back into the house with these girls. And she's like, okay, fine. Charge him. Arrest him. Which I have seen her hold strong on like way more provable cases. So I don't know why for this one she was like, yeah, fine. Arrest him. Well, dun dun. BNS lead a handcuffed Evan Ramsey through the halls. And out of nowhere, Rebecca Ramsey charges him, asking why he did this. And Olivia, like, has to hold her back. They're just, like, screaming at each other. She's like, why would you do this? And he's like, I didn't do anything. Like,
yeah, he's like, what the fuck?
He's like, please, you have to believe me. And she's like, no, no.
I get you.
Talk to the troubled Megan. I know what you did.
How could you do this to Megan? Look at her. She's worn the same jacket for weeks.
Dun-dun. At the arraignment, Mr. Ramsey pleads not guilty, and Cabot does... We have seen this song and dance so many times where she's like, he's a flight risk, he's super rich, and then his lawyer is like, Mr. Ramsey is a pillar of the community, and so many people... Blah, 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 blah.
Court.
Lena Petrovsky is presiding, and she apparently agrees with Cabot and sets a high bail. Cabot asks for an order of protection, barring him from his home and from his children, and Petrovsky agrees. A dun dun. So Dr. Huang is back, and he is interviewing Lily. Benson Stabler and Mrs. Ramsey watch from outside. Mrs. Ramsey tells them that she went to speak with Megan's therapist. The way she worded this was super confusing, but basically, it sounds like Dr. Wharton listed a bunch of symptoms of someone who was being abused. And it sounded exactly like Lily's been behaving. Or it was the way Megan used to behave. I'm not sure which, because of the way they worded that scene.
I think you were right the first time it was Lily, because for some reason, Jody, like they mentioned Jody going to see Dr. Wharton, but now Lily has also seen her. I think just because now they're kind of like thinking that she's helping, you know, bring out these memories. So no, Dr. Wharton does say that Lily is also presenting signs, you know?
Like crying, sleeplessness, the like.
Yeah.
So Dr. Wharton told her Lily is blocking it all out because it's too much. That is how Dr. Wharton speaks. Lily is blocking it out. It's all too much for her.
I want to be a therapist. Just be like, listen, she's blocking it out. It's too much. Bother her.
Rebecca says it's all so clear and laments how she didn't see it before. Dr. Huang exits the interview. And Mrs. Ramsey enters to go see Lily. And meanwhile, Dr. Huang's kind of like talking with the crew. And basically, he says he didn't get anything out of Lily. She's scared. Cabot's like, okay, well, I know we kind of fudged everything, but if we can't get her testimony, we deadass have fucking nothing. Because Megan's testimony means shit.
Yeah. Nobody fucks with Megan at all. Like, no one. Cabot doesn't. The polygraph people are like, I don't know. Nobody fucks with Megan. They're like, yeah, anything. No. It's weird how they're not bringing up the underwears and the pictures yet. Like, because to me, if I were any of them, I'd be like, did we not?
That's like Stabler, the only physical evidence they have.
Stabler literally pulled a giant pair of tidy whiteys out from behind the bed.
No, the CSU tech did with like a, he had like a stick and he was like, these.
That would kind of be my, I'd be like, we found underwear.
Yeah, that, I mean, that is pretty damning.
They're like, we've got nothing. We got nothing at all.
So Dr. Huang says he's going to do his best. Dun dun.
That room that they had Lily in with Huang was awful. It was purple, like the bright, like purple rain, purple walls, red chairs, and a parquet floor. If you don't know what a parquet floor is, Google it. Doesn't belong with purple and red, let me tell you. Dun dun.
Dun dun. Thank you. Appropriate dun dun. So at the crime lab, the forensics tech is talking to Finn and Munch, and he tells them that the DNA proves that the underwear does belong to Evan Ramsey, but there is none of his DNA on Lily's sheets or her nightclothes. There's no prints on the pictures. However, what they did find were these like strips of paper that were cut off the 8.5 by 11s, which I don't know how because they already looked pretty big.
Right.
But these strips were found in the trash and he was able to match them up to the photos. And these little strips have the date the pictures were printed on them. And lo and behold, it was the day that Evan Ramsey was in Baltimore. Dun dun. So back at the Ramseys, the police confiscate the computer. And Rebecca's like, oh, I'm computer illiterate. Couldn't have been me. And B and S are like, okay, well, could one of the kids have done it? And she's like, oh, well, they were at school and I was at my lawyer's office filing for divorce. I was like, Jesus, Rebecca, that was quick.
God.
No trial for Rebecca. And she's like, maybe the date was set wrong. They ask where Megan was and Rebecca can't say. And they also question the housekeeper who was at the grocery store. I should say these pictures were timestamped in addition to having the date on them. So they have a pretty good idea of when they think they were printed. Yeah. So that's why they're kind of looking for this alibi right now. Dun dun. BNS go to question Megan, who explains that she dropped her Tuesday morning class. Since then, she's been meeting with her tutor on Tuesday mornings. And they're like, oh, so this Tuesday. And she's like, oh, well, no, not this Tuesday. He was my boyfriend and we broke up.
That was so confusing. I went back twice. I was like, so what? Megan likes to do this. She likes to kind of, she's like, oh, God, I fucked it up.
Oh, that's okay. I know what you're saying.
I mean?
She tells all her stories like in reverse from like the furthest from the point she's trying to make.
So her tutor was her boyfriend. So that's why she stopped going to tutoring.
Yes, because they broke up. So she didn't
go to tutoring. But then she said it as like, oh, normally I go to tutoring, except for this last Tuesday because we broke up. So now I don't go to tutoring. Girl.
Now, this is not investigated further. It seems like for her Columbia education, Megan is not a good student because her dad went and yelled at her about her grades. And she needed a tutor who she was dating.
Yeah, Megan's, and they've been kind of layering this in very intelligently. Megan's got some troubles. And if you're paying attention, you kind of pick up on it. Like her mom being like, she kind of does this a lot. And then the boyfriend thing has now come up a couple times. Mm-hmm. The way she tells stories is weird. And now, yeah, she's a bad student at Columbia, which a lot of parents would be pissed about. It's expensive, especially. I would assume that Megan, a woman of privilege, does not have scholarships.
So at the time that those pictures were printed, she says that she was at the library studying. And BNS were like, okay, well, can you prove that? And she's like, tons of people saw me. Anyway, I have to go to class. And without, like, saying goodbye to them, she just kind of, like, runs off in the other direction.
She's giving such nerd energy. Like, even when she walks off, she's, like, holding the backpack, kind of, like, stomping.
Have you ever seen Robin Hood Men in Tights?
Oh my God, this is such an unpopular thing to say. I have not.
So there's this scene like after like Robin Hood saves this boy. The boy's like, well, I've got to go. It's getting pretty dark. And then he just starts like screaming, going, ah, ah, and like running off into the woods. And that's how I picture Megan just being like, well, I've got to go. Ah, screaming off into the sunset. That's how I feel about Megan. I'm like, what an unusual girl. So super quick scene. Funch is back with the lab tech from before, who will appear like 10 other times to go over every bit of evidence with the squad.
We don't find his name out till later when Benson says it very hilariously, but it's Miguel, the Renaissance lab tech who has many skills.
Well, what's super funny is I was like, oh, this guy's in a ton of SBU episodes. He's in 3 and they're kind of spaced out oddly. Like he doesn't come back until season 5.
Weird.
He is a detective on CSI and he's in a bunch of episodes. So I've seen him so many times as a police officer that anytime I see him in a show as a cop or as like working in law enforcement, I'm like, oh yeah, there he is for his like 10th time here. So Miguel tells them that Ramsey's computer is clean. And the way they describe this is kind of weird, but like it makes sense for now. But I was like, I didn't think this would have worked this way back then, but basically someone accessed Ramsey's account, but not from their home.
Yeah, he had, the person who did it had his password.
Finn and Munch ask if there's any way to find out what computer logged into this account. And he's like, go ask ISP, I don't know. He's kind of funny. He's cute.
He's like that smirk emoji. Go ask ISP then. Kind of just smirks off, toddling. Every time I picture people smirking, I also picture them going,
toodling and a toddling.
Yeah, just toddling off.
Well, dun dun. Another quick scene. BNS and Kragen walk through the halls as they question Who could have possibly downloaded these pictures? Megan. And they decide to go talk to Dr. Wharton about Lily. And I only say that because it's so fucking obvious at this point. It's like, who could have done it? Who's the only person who was somewhere with a computer at that time?
Seriously. Oh. Megan just screams amiss.
Oh my God. She...
I know. She sucks. We're not going to be nice about her anymore, by the way.
No, we're done.
It's too hard. Sorry. We tried in the beginning. It's too hard.
Well, dun dun, on the streets, Dr. Wharton tells BNS that she's not surprised Lily is resisting questioning. It's like, okay. She's like, yeah, that sounds about right. Olivia gets a call, so like she backs off and Stabler continues to talk to Dr. Wharton. And he's like, okay, well, our psychiatrist thinks Lily is protecting her father, but maybe more comfortable talking to her. And Dr. Wharton is like, oh my God, yes, please. I will clear my schedule.
I would love to be involved in this.
Please. Stabler's like, awesome. So he walks back over to Olivia, who is just hanging up her phone. Oh my God, the download of those pictures happened at a terminal at Columbia University's library. Crazy. Oh my God.
Wild.
What? So, dun dun, they move Megan into the mean interrogation room.
I was thinking that.
Bitch, it's on.
Can you imagine? They're like, get in here. She's like, this isn't the same room as before.
So BNS are like, so your dad did not download those pictures. Megan's like, no, 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 it wasn't me.
No.
And they're like, and she's like, okay, well, I just didn't want him to get away with it again. And I'm like, what do you mean get away with it again? You've never accused him the first time.
Very good point. It's like, it's not again because no one.
This is the first anyone's hearing of this.
Ooh, you fucking horse girl up hair.
So she's crying and she's like, he showed up at my apartment. He's threatened to sue my therapist and put me in a mental hospital. And I'm like, good. Good.
Yeah, Megan, I can believe that 100%, if not 101%.
So dun dun, back in court, Ramsey's lawyer is like, so all that physical evidence was fake as fuck. And now we have a boy judge. And he's like, yeah, that, yeah, we're not doing that. So despite Cabot trying to say that this doesn't change anything.
Yeah, lazily. She's like, well, this doesn't change anything.
Just grasping at straws. Evan Ramsey is free to go. He immediately approaches his family. He's like, and it talks directly to Megan. He's like, I know you didn't mean to do this, but she did. And all the Ramsey women kind of like give him a cold shoulder as they walk past. And then Rebecca is like, I want you moved out by the end of the week. I'm like, SVU, why do you make me side with a man?
I know. This is not what I wanted.
Dun dun. The squad goes to a bar to drink away their sorrows. Stabler is like, God damn it. If Megan hadn't screwed up our case, we might have totally had this guy. So his phone rings. It's probably Kathy. And he steps away. Olivia's still defending Megan. She's like, listen, she was just trying to protect her sister. Munch is like, yeah, the road to heaven is paved with good intentions or whatever. Stabler returns and is like, ooh, that was not Kathy. That was Cragen. Evan Ramsey has been moited.
So Stabler, I swear to God, when he answers the phone, he goes, Stabler.
Someone wrote that on IMDb. Someone's like, Stabler, like, mispronounced his own name.
He calls himself Stabler, like Stab-L-U-R-E.
Now, in his defense, Stabler is really hard to say because you and I have both fucked it up so many times.
Stabler.
And I don't know if you guys have picked up on this. This is another man with the last name Ramsey.
Uh-oh.
Our wrongfully accused friend from last season was Russell Ramsey, wrongfully accused of rape, no less.
Well, dun dun, at Ramsey's office, Melinda Warner tells Benson that Ramsey was shot at close range. An officer brings over Richard Weiss, a company executive who discovered the body, and Weiss tells BNS that they were both working late. He left around 9 to go grab dinner, and he got back around 10, 30, 11. He saw Ramsey's light on, he thought he'd go in to say goodnight, but instead found Evan lying there in a pool of blood. BNS, ask if there is anyone that could have done this. And Weiss is like, I don't know anyone who would have done this. And then he's like, okay, well, things were pretty tense between Ramsey and his father-in-law. Evan Ramsey took the company public, and this pissed off Mr. Sutherland, who felt that he took over the company he had created from the ground up. These charges against Mr. Ramsey only added fuel to the fire. And I wrote, clearly one is way worse than the other. Like, yeah. Fuel to the fire? I'm like, I'd be way madder about, like, you know, abusing my grandchildren than a fucking business dispute.
That might be the fire.
That was kind of like Veronica Tandy's assistant in Peak, who was like, no one would ever want to hurt her. And they were like, well, were people who were fired pretty mad? She's like, yes, absolutely. They were totally murderous.
Oh my God, they were mad all the time. They called, threatened her life constantly. But what does that have to do with this, her murder? Also, another little observation. The cop who brought this coworker in was really hot.
Oh.
And we'll probably never see him again. He's probably not even credited.
See him again. So this very afternoon, Mr. Sutherland came charging into Evan's office and told him he wasn't going to get away with what he did. I guess Evan was trying to reason with him. It didn't work. And Weiss thought it could have even gotten violent, but security came in and escorted Mr. Sutherland out, which must have really stuck in his craw.
This family is so dramatic. The Sutherland clan, they're just like running around, just wreaking havoc.
Evan Ramsey, the biggest mistake he ever did was marrying into this stupid fucking family.
Seriously, he and Lily should just go move to Brooklyn and be chilled the fuck out, honestly.
Oh, the spinoff I never knew I needed.
So I'm so upset about this. I was angry.
Well, dun dun, BNS visit Mr. Sutherland, who is one of those people that collects dead butterflies.
It's in his creepy bug room, is what I wrote in my notes.
Oh, like he's looking at like a butterfly through his magnifying glass. I hate.
Ugh.
I think it's wicked weird.
I think taxidermy, and this is also taxidermy, is really weird. It's just like. And it's also in the room. I know it's probably someone else's actual bug room, but it's got like ivy painted on the walls and all these just like butterflies. And I'm like, this is horrifying.
Maybe I'm like too much of a bleeding heart, but I really don't believe in killing something to collect it.
Like, I agree.
Even a bug. I know it's just a bug, but there's something, I don't know, that does not sit right with me.
No, it's how I feel about animal tourism too. And you agree with me. It's like, there's no need to involve living things in our interests.
If, like, the bug already died, I don't care. But, I mean, I don't think that's, like, normally. Or if you buy it secondhand, I'm kind of little wiggle room there.
Yeah.
For me. But a room, he's rich. He's clearly a collector. He's clearly someone that, like, buys them at auction. I know I'm writing a whole story. But the people like that, people know that people are going to pay a lot of money, so they go out in the world and like capture these endangered species for no good reason.
Exactly. It's the same with exotic pets. Look how fun those monkeys are. It's like, that's why we have a bunch of monkeys as pets in America, and we shouldn't. And if any of you have one, I don't care how you got it, you're an idiot. Seriously. Stop listening to this podcast right fucking now.
Yeah, we don't do. We're very strict with animals on this podcast.
Very strict. So if you don't believe in that.
Fuck yourself. Oh, anyway. I wrote, I hate the rich. I do.
Eat them.
Mr. Sutherland tells BNS he's glad Evan Ramsey's dead, but he didn't do it. And he's in a pretty good mood. He is looking at his butterflies. He's grinning. He's like, yeah, I'm glad he's dead. Did not do it, but whatever. He tells the detectives that last night he went out to dinner with his daughter, he dropped her off, and then he went home to bed. Olivia's like, okay, well, Evan was killed with a .32 caliber bullet, and we happen to know that you have a .32 caliber gun. They call it a Dillinger, but I'm not a gun girly, so I'm just going to say a .32 caliber gun.
Yeah, it's a gun.
He goes to show them this gun, as he's also like rattling off, he's like, I also have a Civil War era rifle that still shoots, and I have this gun and that gun, and this one has a pretty pearl handle. And he goes to show them this gun that is kept in this like very ornate display case with the key. He goes to unlock it, and then he discovers that one is missing. And BNS are like, we're going to take you downtown. I will say he does seem genuinely surprised. Dun dun. In the mean interrogation room, Olivia tells Mr. Sutherland that Evan stole his company and molested his grandchildren, and it would only make sense that he would want to kill them.
I like how she lists the company thing first.
She's like, hey, you stole your company, fucked up your grandkids. No wonder you want to kill him. And he's like, yeah, I definitely have motivation. but I didn't. BNS. That's all I wrote for that scene. I guess I did not care.
Moving on.
Nothing important is really said in that scene. It's just like basically they're like, you have reason to do it. And he's like, I do, but I didn't. So BNS go to talk to Cragen and they tell him that Mr. Sutherland fits, but they themselves are unsure. He seemed genuinely surprised that the gun was missing. So Cragen tells them that CSU found a gun that fits the description of Mr. Sutherland's missing gun in the gutter at the parking structure of Ramsey's office building. And hey, it's being tested right now.
Thank God. Thank God the killer was smart enough to leave it right outside the building.
Wow. So, dun-dun, BNS meet with the same crime tech again.
Gal, the Renaissance crime tech.
It's so funny. In CSI, they have, like, a different tech for everything. Like, there's a ballistics expert. There's a DNA guy. There's someone who... Okay, those are the only two I can think of. But ballistics and DNA would not have been, like, the same person.
And computer, like, because he was the one tracing, like, how someone hacked into Evan Ramsey's computer. So he's very much well-rounded. And he knows it, too, because he gives him little snide comments all the time. He's like, well,
So the crime scene tech confirms it was Mr. Sutherland's gun, and it was the gun that was used in Evan Ramsey's murder. However, there are no fingerprints. There were fingerprints on the shell casings, and the prints do not belong to Sutherland. So they do have the murder weapon, but they don't have their killer.
Got your weapon, not your killer, Miguel says.
That's one of his snarky comments.
Mm-hmm. Because I forget what Olivia says, but she goes, well, unfortunately, Miguel, we need the fingerprints.
But unfortunately, Miguel, they don't match Sutherland's prints.
Got your weapon, not your killer.
Well, I'm like, okay, you have a ton of other suspects, so go match the fingerprints to the other three ding-dongs in this scenario.
For real. They're like, what now? It leaves us with Megan, the most likely suspect.
It's just like the like the printed child sex abuse material where I'm like, also, where the hell did she find that? That's concerning.
Yeah, like, where did you get this? They never ask her, because that's illegal, too. You downloaded
it. She's an adult. She downloaded
it. She's 18 years old. Yeah, you can get in trouble for this. Yeah, no, they're like, oh, Megan. Whatever.
So BNS head to the Ramsey home to talk to Rebecca, and she tells them that she was at dinner with her father last night and got home around 9, which basically kind of corroborates what Mr. Sutherland had already been telling them when they accused him. Her daughters and housekeeper were home, and they all went to bed. And fucking Megan is here. She enters the room, still wearing that fucking quilted coat. And she's like, what are they doing here?
Your dad's
been
murdered. And they were working on this case.
So Stabler asks her where she was between the hours of 7 and 11. And Megan says that she picked up Jody from dance class and brought her back to the house. Rebecca's like, I wanted all my girls under my roof. Okay. So then she goes and sends Megan to go check on her sisters. And she, like her father, is basically like, I'm not sorry that Evan's dead, but I, too, did not kill him.
For all we know, it was someone random who has nothing to do with this case.
But also used your dad's gun.
They're all being so frustrating. Cause it's like, you know, one of you did it.
Yeah. So, dun-dun, back in the bullpen, the detectives are basically all discussing the Ramsey alibis and and saying that it's pretty convenient that they're all alibying each other. Finn chimes in to say that someone called Evan's office from Megan's car phone between 9:30 and 10, and it looks like Megan does not have an alibi after all. Also, a car phone?
Thank you. I was going to say, spoiled little bitch. First of all, you have a car in Manhattan. Second of all, you have a car phone.
You hate your dad so much, but you take his money for your college tuition and your car phone?
I'm going to fight this bitch.
Dun dun. On the streets, Finn and Munch chat with the housekeeper and ask what time Mrs. Ramsey went to bed. She says 9 o'clock, and she tells them that the girls went to bed around the same time. But this would have been helpful to say earlier. Later, they went out and didn't get back until after 11. They went up to Jody's room and closed the door. And she's like, and I heard lots of crying. she knows she just screwed over her employer. She's like, yeah.
I like like how in this house, it must be so disturbing to work here because there's just all these people shutting doors and locking them and crying.
I know. This is like a house of horrors.
She's got to be thinking like, God damn. It's so scary.
So B&S catch up with Mrs. Ramsey and Jody on the streets. And Mrs. Ramsey is pissy, saying they are meeting their priest. And she asks if this can wait. And they're like, no, not really. Can we speak to Jody? And Jody's like, moi? Me?
Like, me? You'd like to speak to me?
Why would you like to speak to me? Again, Mrs. Ramsey insists everyone went to bed at 9. And Stabler looks at Jody and he's like, you've already lied to your mother. Don't make it harder on yourself by lying now. And Jody finally admits that Mr. Ramsey had been calling Megan and she wanted him to confess. And he told her he wouldn't do it over the phone. So they drove to his office. Megan went inside and Jody waited in the car. And a few minutes later, she came out and they left. Uh-oh. Dun dun. So B&S walk with Megan through campus and ask her to go through her story one more time. She's like, oh my God, no, I don't remember. Olivia is like, dude, can you cut the fucking shit? We have your phone records. And Megan's like, no, guys, like sometimes I just like black out.
The way Benson, I think she gets in front of her physically and stops her. She's like, you cannot be fucking serious.
Yeah, so we are almost at the end of this episode and Megan is now for the first time being like, oh yeah, sometimes I black out and I don't remember stuff.
And she says it, a very classic Megan, and she says it too. She's like, sometimes I black out. Kind of like everyone should have known that. Like, no, I'm Megan. Obviously, I have a lot of problems and I black out. I want to black you out, bitch. I swear to God.
She insists that these blackouts happen and she starts to get hostile. She's like, oh, this is just what happens to me. And according to Dr. Wharton, same with her memories of being raped up until a few months ago. She's like, I blocked those out. And then I've only just started remembering them a few months ago. It's like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
So a dun-dun, B&S go to visit Dr. Wharton, who tells them she is no longer at liberty to discuss Megan's treatment. That stupid bitch Megan must have just called her and been like, don't tell him anything.
I know, she got in her car phone. She's like, Dr. Wharton, don't tell them anything. They're not on my side anymore. They're questioning my victimhood.
So Stabler says she is a suspect in her father's murder. And he's like, if you had any inkling of this, you would have had to report it. And Dr. Wharton is like, oh my God, I have been a therapist for 15 years. I do not need a lecture on ethics. And I'm like, I don't feel like that's that long.
No, and so many therapists need a refresher, actually, on ethics. A lot of them do.
So Olivia asks her some general questions about her techniques. They're like, okay, so like if we can't talk about Megan, why don't you just tell me what you do in general? How do you recover these repressed memories? Wharton is like, through intense therapy. This is like one of the funniest scenes in the whole episode. B&S kind of stare at her like, and?
The way Stabler looks like he wants to reach over and just like crack her neck to the side.
He finally is like, can you be more specific? She's like, well, the process starts by generating a flashback. And as she's talking like through her process, B&S slowly get these looks on their faces like, oh no, this woman is a dead ass fucking quack. So Dr. Wharton goes on. She's like, first we start with a flashback, but then these flashbacks, they become snapshots and then collages. And finally, we have a complete picture. And B&S are like, oh, shit.
Sort of like drawing a picture, right? Like drawing one from scratch versus a puzzle of actual photos.
So Olivia's like, okay, so you've got these pictures. How do you know if a patient is telling the truth? And she's like, oh, well, I just get a doctor to administer sodium amytal. And Stabler's like, truth serum? And she's like, oh, it's just like a tranquilizer. It helps me look for inconsistencies. And Stabler's like, so what happens when you overlook inconsistencies? And she's like, I don't overlook them. I explore them. I have so many success stories. And Olivia's like, is Megan one of your success stories?
Ooh.
Dr. Wharton's like, I don't think I want to talk to you anymore.
Mm.
She like leaves her own office in a bit of a huff.
She does leave her own office.
So dun dun, B&S are now walking through the halls with Dr. Huang. Olivia looks so chic. She is wearing like black pants and this like black leather trench coat. And she just looks cool as hell. Dr. Huang tells the detectives that sodium amytal creates memories. It does not help with repressed memories.
Yeah, I was going to say it just gets you really fucking high and you hallucinate, it sounds like.
I was going to say it sounds fun, but...
Oh, it does sound fun.
Except for the part where it'd probably be fun for a sane person, not someone who, like, makes up that their dad molested them. Sodium amytal has fallen out of favor with most reputable therapists. This drug places the patients in a semi-hypnotic state, and then they are very vulnerable to manipulation. He recalls a case wherein a woman convinced the police to dig up a park in search of bodies her father had buried there after raping and torturing them. And despite the police never finding a single body, she still truly believed that they were there. It was later learned that this whole thing had been planted in her head by her therapist after she was given sodium amytal. Munch brings over Megan's medical records and reveals, dun-dun-dun-dun, Megan is a virgin. Evan Ramsey never did shit to her. Now, my one critique here is that this whole examination is based on the fact that her hymen is still intact. And you know how much we hate hymen talk if you want to head on back to Honor and listen to us rant about it there. And in fact, considering that she talked so much about how bad she was at horseback riding, I'm surprised her hymen actually isn't broken from her irresponsibly riding horses. So dun-dun, Benson, Stabler, and Cragen head to Cabot's office to basically give her the bad news. Megan Ramsey was never raped. Everyone looks grim as fuck as they realize they prosecuted Evan Ramsey over nothing.
Am I mistaken, Brittany, or we never see Megan again? We never get the satisfaction of knowing what her thoughts are on all of this buffoonery.
Oh, no, it's like really upsetting because I know exactly how the scene would play out and it'd be really annoying. But we never get to see her face the fact that all of this shit was in her head and she essentially ruined her father and her family's life.
Yeah.
Over something her therapist helped her cook up. Cabot tells them that the fingerprints on the shell casings belong to Megan, and Olivia angrily says that none of this would have happened if the therapist hadn't filled her mind with garbage. This is the most lit someone gets this whole episode.
No, it's true. That's the only time anyone gets really upset.
Cragen rightfully points out that the therapist didn't pull the trigger. Megan did. And Cabot's like, okay, well, since she hid evidence and lied about it, that shows a clear state of mind. And she is going to subpoena Jody, and she can either testify against her sister or be in contempt.
Good. Fucking done. Done. I hate these bitches.
Dun dun. So now we're with the grand jury, and Jody tells the court that Evan called Megan after the charges were dropped. He said he wanted to be a family again. Megan wanted to put an end to this whole thing, but she said she was scared, and that's why she asked her poor 15-year-old sister Jody to come along.
I know. I mean, really.
I mean, I know I've come down hard on Jody, but the fact that her older sister made her come with her to this.
Megan just sucks in general because even like when Lily was being spoken to when Benson was talking to Lily initially, and she's like, Megan said my daddy did a bad thing. So Megan's just been running around torturing everybody with this, like talking to her little sister when she shouldn't be, because it's also an active investigation. You shouldn't be putting shit in her head, dragging her other younger sister around, like just being a fucking suck. I don't even know. I'm just so angry that my vocabulary is deteriorating.
And a freshman in college is so different than a freshman in high school, maturity wise. So it's like basically like legally too. It's an adult bringing a child along to face her father, who, even though we know that this poor guy didn't do jack shit, she allegedly believes is a violent offender.
It's just Megan needing that validation. You know what I mean? Like we heard about it from her mom earlier. It's like she does this a lot, and even the mom said in the beginning before she believed her, she was like, oh, she's roping her sisters into her shit, kind of like as she always does. Mm-hmm. Oh my god, this girl is so, yeah, she's awful. She's abusive to her sisters, I believe, by way of like just emotionally abusing them, and now probably weaponizing this and being like, Jody, I'm so scared, you have to help protect me against dad. You're right. And it's like, it's your younger sister. Oh, I could go on for hours. I hate this bitch.
So Jody tells the grand jury that they drove to her dad's office building, and she starts to well up, and Cabot's kind of like trying to push her gently to continue her story. Jody starts to cry harder and whispers that all of a sudden, Megan didn't do it, and it was her. She didn't mean to. The gun just went off, and she's crying, and she whispers that she's sorry. So dun-dun, In the halls of the courthouse, Cabot gets yelled at by Executive Assistant District Attorney Stan Villani. He's played by Ron Liebman, who plays Rachel's dad, Dr. Green, and Friends.
Ah!
He is going to show up a few times in this role in the first half of season three, so I thought I'd just give him a little intro. He yells at her. She defends herself. I guess we find out now that Jody has immunity for testifying against Megan. But since she just revealed that she's actually the killer, it's created this legal quandary. I think there's concern that Megan really did do it, but yeah. Jody is now covering for Megan and she can't be held accountable. And therefore, they have no leverage to then turn Jody against Megan if, in fact, Megan really did do it.
I have thoughts on that, too. Like, if Megan really did do it. But it's so funny how no matter what, this girl just escapes any possible responsibility for this.
She's Teflon.
Maybe she's just that crazy and they're kind of realizing it. They're not like telling us per se, but like maybe she's just that crazy. They're like, she's fucked. Like, we couldn't even put her in jail if we wanted to. That's how fucking crazy this girl is. And I'm like, anyway.
But they don't do a good job of showing it because she presents as a little like, woo! But I'm so mad at her all the time. And I think if she actually seemed more really disturbed, I'd be like, okay, well, Megan's got a lot of problems, so we can't really blame her.
The best way I can describe it to like an audience member who maybe hasn't seen this is it's like that friend you have who's always got some shit. Like, it's always some shit. Like, every time you see this friend, it's always some shit. And it doesn't matter if it's real or if it's like imagined. They're just constantly like, oh my God, my parents and I are fighting again, and my boyfriend, and I'm dating my tutor. And you're just like, Megan, I can't. Like, it's every fucking day with you. That's just how she seems. But like, the fact that they're not holding her accountable for anything is giving, this girl is so far off the farm, they can't even call her home.
I mean, she should be on probation or something, at least for basically getting her dad killed and planting evidence and making false accusations.
Yeah, she planted evidence. She lied. I mean, I don't care if it was like a lie that implanted in her head. Like, at some point you have to take some accountability and be like, I don't have a memory of this. Maybe it didn't happen.
Well, dun dun, Cabot and Olivia interview Jody, who is with her mother and her lawyer. Cabot tells her that she has immunity. However, that immunity goes away if she lies to Alex. All bets are off.
Yeah, she's like, don't lie to me. Like, don't. We're sick of you.
She basically comes in and is like, you know you have immunity. You know you can basically, like, get away with this guy's murder, even though she's 15 and probably wouldn't have gotten in huge trouble anyway. I mean, she could probably be tried as an adult. She's a rich 15, so no.
There was definitely an element of premeditation in this, too. So.
Oh, yeah.
They super want to charge her, but I guess they just can't.
So Jody tells Cabot that Megan was too afraid to go in alone, so Jody went with her.
Ugh.
So when Evan got up from his desk, Megan just started to scream, which I can only imagine was just like, what the fuck? So I don't know if she was screaming at him or if she was just like, leave me alone!
I think she was doing the latter. I think it was that. I think that she's sitting there in her fucking barn coat in that same sweater she's been wearing for 2 weeks. And he probably stood up and she just started shrieking. Like, that is the only way I can picture it happening. It's just very Megan.
So he went over and grabbed her and shook her and told her to be quiet, because I'm sure this was like, he's there. He's just like, hey, we're going to talk. And she just starts screaming and he's like, okay, you need to shut the fuck up.
It's like, stop.
So Megan dropped her purse and Jody saw the gun. So she picked it up and told her dad to let Megan go. He wouldn't listen and just kept yelling. And poor Jody yelled, stop. And he looked at her and reached for the gun. It went off. So tears are running down Jody's face and she's like, he looked so surprised. She says, I loved my dad. I just wanted him to stop hurting Megan. So Megan went there with the gun.
I don't know how this isn't like I think she planned to kill him personally. I think Megan planned to point that gun in his face and go apologize and admit to it or I'm going to fucking kill you or something. And then she had her dumb little crazy freak out when he stood up. But I guess, yeah, at first I was like thinking maybe Megan did do it and Jody was just covering up for her because she felt so bad about the quote abuse. But now I can actually picture Megan more being like, I think you said this earlier, Megan's all talk.
Yeah.
Just all drama. Like, so I can actually picture it going down like this where she really did like go and take the gun, put it in her purse, her fucking saddlebag that she carries from the barn. Jody's freaking out because she's like, oh my God, everyone's fucking screaming. Yeah, no, I can picture all that.
And we can only assume, because we now do know that like Evan Ramsey's a good, decent person, she probably was like basically performing quite the scene, so much so that he was like trying to get her to calm down.
Maybe he didn't know the coworker had stepped out for dinner, which I would argue that Megan and Jody seemed to know. It sounds like they were waiting in the car until that coworker left. And then they went up, you know, because, I mean, I wouldn't put it past them because they're both such idiots to bring a gun to an office where other people work and think that maybe they wouldn't get in trouble for having it regardless of the situation. Like, ladies, it's not self-defense if you take the gun to the person and shoot them without provocation.
Yes. Well, so let's discuss the basically inciting incident of this whole episode. I'm not 100% sure what was happening because it sounds to me like Megan was refusing to talk to her family, but somehow her father knew that she was, I'm going to say failing classes, but we at the very least know she was doing poorly at school based on yes. like wording. And he knew about this boyfriend. So I don't know if this boyfriend was a problem in that like he was abusive or if he was just like one of those boyfriends that like distracted her and she wasn't doing well in school. And he was like, I'm paying your tuition. Break up with him.
It seems like it was a toxic situation. Jody or the dad mention that the boyfriend was controlling. It sounds sort of like, just based on this, it's all been going on for the last like couple months, like month or something, or couple months. So I think the night in question sounds like he followed her there because she was avoiding him and her family. And then he was like, yo, what's up with these grades? We're paying $300 million for you to go to a Columbia University. You need to break up with this guy who's torturing you and do better in school. And then she probably started screaming.
And he was like, okay, well, I'm going to sue your therapist and send you away. And she was like, how could you do this to me?
That's got to be what it is. And yeah, we never get like an actual, they drop little breadcrumbs, but we don't really get a real diagnosis for Megan. We don't get anything. Nothing that I'm comfortable with other than that she's a stupid bitch.
So the therapist says that she came with depression and bulimia, but we can't even trust this therapist. So it's like,
right. It's like a lot to be like depression and bulimia, incest.
Well, dun dun. In Cragen's office, the squad kind of stands before Rebecca Ramsey as she faces all of them. And she's like, I don't even know how to make sense of any of this. My husband is dead, killed by her child. And she starts to cry, thinking how awful it must have been for Evan to have the people he loved most turn on him. Which I'm glad she says that because I was kind of like, oh, the entire time, I don't know. Evan's pretty sympathetic because you kind of always have like an inkling of what really happened. And once you know, you're kind of like, you want someone to say it, like how fucked up.
It's so heartbreaking even thinking about him in court that day going, like, turning to, he's so excited, you know, and he turns around and he goes, I know you didn't mean to do this. And they all just look at him like he's disgusting. And it was heartbreaking.
I know.
And he still goes to work at, like, I know he stole it, but her dad's office, like, under the guise of providing for them. It's just really sad.
Yeah.
And I'm more sad that they're making me side with a man so early in this season.
I know. Episode one. God.
Dare they do this to us? This is not how I planned my Friday.
So Cragen says that this is a burden that they all have to share, even though I'm like, you guys didn't really do that much wrong for once.
They're all on Xanax because he's like, we all share that burden, Mrs. Ramsey.
I know, because then Cabot kind of even sedately tells her that Jody's not going to be prosecuted. And Mrs. Ramsey's like, I kind of don't care because she's going to prosecute herself like every day. She's going to torture herself about killing her own father.
How hard must this be for Mrs. Ramsey? Because this is the most right you'll ever be in your life. You'll never be more right than this moment. But your fucking husband is dead.
I know. And she had even said to Megan, no, that's not true. No, that's not true. I don't know what you're talking about. And then finally, like, Megan wore everybody down with all her accusations. And I'd be like, oh, remember that? And now your dad's dead.
This is like a mother's and a wife's worst nightmare, because it is obviously, and this constantly comes up in cases like this. Actually, Olivia said it earlier, and I was like, you just hate mothers and rich mothers. But she was like, it wouldn't be the first time a wife sided with her husband over her children. So we really do see that a lot. But it's literally your worst nightmare to have this presented against your husband, who presumably you married because you thought they would never do something like this to your children. And you want to trust your kids because, like, why would they lie?
Yeah. Rebecca asks, what about Dr. Wharton? How many more families will she be allowed to destroy?
Good question.
Well, dun, dun. At Dr. Wharton's office, she is transcribing her notes into a recorder like a crazy person.
Which is weird.
I know. It's like, isn't that supposed to be the other way? Cabot enters and hands her a subpoena for the medical records of Megan, Jody, and Lily. Dr. Wharton sees through the open door that Olivia, outside her office, is going through all her records, and she, like, runs over, hollering that her records are confidential.
Oh my god.
Olivia, queen of files, is like, I'm gonna take special care of these.
Oh, and she, yeah, like, she runs up to Olivia, again, screaming, and, like, grabs her, and Olivia looks at her like, if you don't get your paws off me. Also, Mariska Hargitay is so tall.
Stabler approaches and arrests her for reckless endangerment. They tell her that Megan's new therapist is going to testify against her for all the damage she did to Megan. Furthermore, Dr. Wharton has been reported to the board and lost her license. And with some satisfaction, Olivia tells her, this is certainly a day that Dr. Wharton will never forget. Executive producer Dick Wolf, welcome to season 3.
Strong starter to the season. And I'll make this quick, but because everyone should Google this. It was a crazy thing. But this sort of reminded me of the Satanic Panic issue.
Yes, yes.
There's a documentary called The Search for Satan, and it's from, I think, 1990. And it was Frontline by PBS, and it's on YouTube. And essentially, these therapists went to, like, a convention where they learned about ritualistic cult sexual abuse perpetrated against children who were members of a cult, and they diagnosed people with it. Like, it was very similar to this. They were like, we think you might have been ritualistically abused in a cult.
And I think they then ended up, like, giving people, like, fake memories because they kind of drilled it home so hard that people were like, oh my god, maybe I did forget that. So they ended up traumatizing people. I have a new theory.
Ooh.
So Lily Ramsey and all her nightmares, why her dad had to keep coming to her room. She was getting nightmares from Megan coming around and being like, daddy's really bad. Daddy did a really bad thing. And that freaked her out enough to have nightmares that meant that Evan Ramsey was having to go into her room and deal with her wetting the bed.
You know what? That's a really good point. Starting shit and, like, telling them all about their family trauma probably was stressing the family out.
Yeah.
Now more than ever, we've decided, everyone, need to institute the Ramsey Award.
Yes, that is honestly the biggest takeaway from this episode, that that not one, but two Ramses have fallen prey to lying, manipulative women.
Women. And I was shocked, and I remember I sent Brittany a voice memo. I was like, are we being given yet another wrongfully accused Ramsey? A murdered, wrongfully accused Ramsey? And so at first we think, oh, good, he's not going to jail. He's not going to get... because Benson and Stabler even remind him. They're like, you know what happens to child molesters in jail? And I'm like, but he's not going to jail because he didn't do it. And he got killed anyway.
Got killed anyway. Well, I think now, retrospectively, we can revoke Russell Ramsey's Gina Silver and give him the true award that he deserved, which is the Ramsey Award.
The Ramsey Award. And we'll define the parameters now, although we'll probably have to redefine them later as more of these incidents come up.
Honestly, I only think we're going to get one of these a season. This happens so rarely.
I truly don't like having to side with men, but here we are with the Ramsey Award.
I also don't like getting proven wrong, but that happened to me so many times with Monique Jeffries last season.
To win the Ramsey Award, you must be a man, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, a man. And you must be accused of sexual assault that you did not commit and thereby murdered because of it. Simple.
Yes.
Very simple. R.I.P. Evan Ramsey, we feel so bad for you. I hope that you were reunited with your long-lost son, Russell Ramsey, where you can watch these dumb bitches just rot in jail. Well, actually, no, none of his dumb bitches are rotten in jail.
And I just realized they were going to indict Megan and then realized they couldn't because it was really Jody. So, honestly, Megan still should have fucking gone to jail.
So I guess they really just let her off because they were like, she was coerced. She also brought a gun. She brought a gun in New York.
She loaded the gun. Her fingerprints were still on the casing, so she is still the person who loaded the gun. And she stole it!
Like, how? She committed several. And Brittany, the most important one that you brought up earlier, she downloaded child pornography and printed it out and disseminated it to another child. She put it under another child's bed.
Yes.
What is going on?
So, yeah, I'm really sorry. That girl should be in jail.
So in two more Tuesdays, you'll hear from us again, season 3, episode 2. Bye, everybody.
Bye, squad.